state. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that they're going to just keep him locked up there because the U.S. will appeal for months and months until he disintegrates physically and emotionally.
We have 20 seconds, Chris Hedges. What you want to see right now?
Is what's that?
We have 10 seconds. What you want to see right now for Julian Assange?
Well, Julian Assange is probably the most important publisher, of the last few decades. He represents everything that I care about in terms of shining a lens into the inner workings of power and exposing the kinds of crimes of power. And the fact that so many people have turned their back on
him. We're going to have to leave it there, Chris Hedges. We thank you so much for being with us, and Ramesh Srinivasan. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune into KBOO for Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. This retrospective program honors Dr. King's work through a combination of archives, audio, and contemporary interviews, featuring artists, activists, public officials, and community members who have participated in this event over the years. Bridge Over Troubled Waters draws inspiration from Dr. King's mission to ensure peace, social justice, civil rights, and human dignity for all. Again, that's Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, on Monday, January the 18th, from noon to 5:30 p.m., here on Community Radio, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Legislature swears in its new members today, including 4 first-year lawmakers of color. The Seattle Police Department suspends 2 officers that attended the Capitol riots, and the House of Representatives introduces an article of impeachment against President Trump. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 11th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Legislature is swearing in a record number of people of color as new and returning members at the Capitol on Monday. The state legislature will now include a record 12 people of color with the new addition of Vietnamese American Con Pham, Latino Ricky Ruiz, Latina Winsvay Campos, and Somali immigrant Casey Jama. The state house will now be 15% non-white. However, these increases do not change the fact that white people have a disproportionate hold on power in the legislature, as people of color make up 25% of Oregon's population. The new group of lawmakers are more diverse in age as well. It includes the youngest woman member in Oregon history, Campos, a Latina representing the Alloa area, who turned 25 in November. All 4 new people of color in the legislature are replacing departing white Democrats, 3 by winning contested Democratic primaries and 1 by winning appointment to the Senate seat vacated by new Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. All 35 Republicans already in the legislature or being sworn in Monday are white. A man arrested Friday for firing a gun at the Mark Hatfield Federal Courthouse in Portland also attended the Stop the Steal rally in Salem. Cody Melby was arrested for firing several rounds into the courthouse on Friday evening. Court documents from Marion County show Melby was arrested for trespassing while in possession of a firearm earlier that week at the far-right rally on January 6th, at the same time as the attempted coup at the U.S. Capitol. Melby is from Beaver Creek and has a YouTube channel where he professes alt-right ideologies like the false theory that the 2020 election was stolen and other QAnon conspiracy theories. In one video, Melby calls on President Trump to use the Insurrection Act against local officials like Governor Kate Brown, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, and media figures like Anderson Cooper and Mark Zuckerberg. The damage from the rounds Melby fired was not severe, but if Multnomah County chooses to prosecute, he could be fined $250,000 or spend up to 10 years in prison if the damages amount to more than $100. Melby is currently in custody at the Multnomah County Jail. At least two Seattle police officers are currently under investigation for their role in last Wednesday's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The officers were placed on administrative leave after the Seattle Police Department was notified two off-duty officers were photographed among crowds at the rally. The city's Office of Police Accountability is currently investigating any role these and any other Seattle police officers played in the mob that stormed the Capitol building. In a press release Friday, Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz expressed the department's continued support for First Amendment rights, but added, quote, "The violent mob and events that unfolded at the U.S. Capitol were unlawful and resulted in the death of another police officer," end quote. According to Chief Diaz, any officer found to be an active participant in the insurrection will be immediately fired. The officers' identities have not been released at this time. Seattle is among several cities nationwide currently investigating officers for their participation in Wednesday's violence. One Capitol Police officer told BuzzFeed News multiple rioters flashed police badges in attempt to gain access to the building. Police unions across the country endorsed Donald Trump in his 2020 campaign, including the Fraternal Order of Police, the nation's largest police union. Their support for Trump is largely due to his emphasis on law and order. No members of the Portland Police Bureau or any of Oregon's law enforcement agencies have been linked to last week's insurrection at this time. The Oregon Health Authority reported 2,868 new cases of COVID-19 over the weekend, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 125,683. Oregon health officials also reported 30 new deaths over the weekend, raising the state's death toll to 1,605. Marion County had the highest number of cases on Sunday with 233, followed by Multnomah County with 229, and Washington County with 180 cases. There are currently 403 people hospitalized statewide, with 84 patients in intensive care units. The Oregon Health Authority reported the state's vaccination total climbed to more than 97,000 doses after roughly 8,500 were administered on Saturday. In a move that surprised and upset their own employees, some hospitals in the state have been vaccinating workers who may not yet qualify. Oregon Health and Science University has offered the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to all of its staff and students, including those who are working from home and others who may not yet meet the CDC definition of frontline healthcare personnel. The Providence Health System has also given the vaccine to staff who are not at any risk of patient exposure. As of Friday, Oregon's vaccine rollout has lagged behind other states, and more than half of the frontline healthcare workers in Multnomah County have yet to be vaccinated. President-elect Joe Biden got his second dose of the coronavirus vaccine on Monday, 3 weeks after receiving the first dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Nationally, more than 22.5 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the coronavirus. More than 375,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 255,000 cases per day, an increase of 38% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 90.6 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.9 million people have died across the world. The U.S. House of Representatives introduced an article of impeachment against President Donald Trump this morning, citing high crimes and misdemeanors related to his role in Wednesday's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The move to impeach the president came after House Republicans blocked a resolution calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office. Republican Representative Alex Mooney of West Virginia blocked the measure from receiving unanimous consent. The House is set to conduct a floor vote on the measure Tuesday evening, but it is not expected to pass the Senate. The article of impeachment was introduced by members of the House Judiciary Committee and co-sponsored by at least 218 Democrats. It charges Trump with, quote, incitement of insurrection under the 14th Amendment, which prohibits anyone involved in open rebellion or insurrection against the government from holding public office. The article cites the president's misinformation campaign against election results, as well as his inflammatory speech on Wednesday, as evidence of incitement. Shortly after Trump's speech on Wednesday, a mob of insurrectionists stormed the U.S. Capitol, assaulting police and physically breaking doors and windows to breach the building while members of Congress were inside certifying election results. Five people died in the violence, including a Capitol Hill police officer. President Trump's January 2nd phone call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is also cited in the impeachment documents. During that call, Trump is heard threatening Raffensperger, saying he needs to find the votes needed to overturn election results. A House vote on impeachment is expected Wednesday morning unless President Trump resigns or Vice President Pence chooses to utilize the 25th Amendment before then. The article has enough support to pass the House, but will likely not be considered by the Senate until members return from recess on January 19th. If passed, this will be the first time in history a U.S. president is impeached twice. Some lawmakers are calling for a delay in impeachment proceedings until after the Biden administration is settled in the White House, but most want to see immediate action. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters on Sunday, quote, "The president's threat to America is urgent, and so too will be our action." Democrats are set to push forward with Trump's second impeachment, but Senate leaders are not in any hurry. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The president did commit impeachable offenses. There's a little doubt in my mind about that.
Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania is the second Republican senator to now call for President Donald Trump's resignation after last week's U.S. Capitol breach. Trump encouraged rallygoers to march to the building to protest his loss to President-elect Joe Biden. Six people have now died, including two Capitol police officers, one who committed suicide over the weekend. Investigators say hundreds of people could eventually be charged. There are new reports that pro-Trump dark money groups were behind the rally. House Democrats plan to introduce an impeachment resolution today, which reportedly has more than 190 co-sponsors. Toomey questions the usefulness of impeachment proceedings with the inauguration coming up on January 20th.
I don't know as a practical matter that it is actually even possible to do an impeachment in the handful of days that are left.
Democrats are weighing if impeaching Trump for a second time would slow down the Biden administration's initial priorities, including cabinet confirmations and a new COVID relief bill. Some Republicans who protested the election results now claim that holding Trump accountable would sow division, suggesting that the hypocrisy would be on Biden's head, who campaigned as a uniter. Talking with CNN on Sunday, House Majority Whip Democrat James Clyburn of South Carolina was vague.
Let's give President-elect Biden the 100 days he needs to get his agenda off and running, and maybe we'll send the articles sometimes after that.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said only in a letter to his colleagues on Saturday that the upper chamber could not, quote, dispose, unquote, of articles of impeachment until January 19th. Talking with CBS, his colleague Republican Roy Blunt in Missouri sounded dismissive as well.
The president should be very careful over the next 10 days that his behavior is what you'd expect from the leader of the greatest country in the world. Now, my personal view is that the president touched the hot stove on Wednesday and is unlikely to touch it again.
Protests were held around the country this weekend from Trump supporters as well as those calling for both Trump and Vice President Mike Pence to be impeached. Amazon joined Facebook and Google, taking action against Parler, a social network popular with conservatives for user posts promoting violence at the Capitol, including one that called for the execution of Vice President Mike Pence. Amazon provides Parler's web hosting. Parler CEO John Matz told Fox News they had removed some posts and were being scapegoated.
They just don't want us on the internet. They just want to get rid of us.
Trump supporters flocked to the site after the president was blocked elsewhere. Many online speech experts say the actions are too little too late. Others are crying foul. How to balance free speech and seditious organizing is not going away. California Republican Devin Nunes called for a Department of Justice investigation into the social media sites.
You get shadow banned. Nobody gets to see you. They get to decide what's violent or not violent. It's preposterous.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, speaking with anti-herbicide activist and author Carol Van Strum about fighting wanton pesticide use in the Pacific Northwest. At 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 49 degrees. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for the Greater Portland metro area through Wednesday at 10 a.m. due to excessive rainfall. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1908, President Theodore Roosevelt declares the massive Grand Canyon in northwestern Arizona a national monument. Today, more than 5 million people visit the canyon each year. The quote of the day is from South Korean politician and former Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, who said, quote, "We are the first generation to be able to end poverty and the last generation that can take steps to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Future generations will judge us harshly if we fail to uphold our moral and historical responsibilities." There have been long-standing calls to expand legal aid services to more Americans who cannot afford to hire their own attorney but also do not qualify for assistance. Advocates for expansion say it's needed for a variety of situations in civil courts, and the movement received a boost when a U.S. Supreme Court justice wrote a newspaper opinion column calling for these changes. Mike Moen has more with the Public News Service.
The movement to expand affordable legal services is receiving renewed focus since a U.S. Supreme Court justice has made a public endorsement of the idea. Conservative-leaning Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote an op-ed for USA Today in recent months, calling on states to find creative ways for more Americans to get free or affordable legal guidance, especially in non-criminal cases. Examples include establishing a will or dealing with small claims issues. Rich LeMay of Legal Services in North Dakota says this kind of advocacy is long overdue.
Attorneys go to school for this, and quite frankly, some of the attorneys don't have it figured out. It's a lot to expect that a person is going to be able to do everything the way the court requires.
Even for people who do qualify for legal aid, LeMay says programs like his don't have a wide range of resources to cover every kind of case. Arizona now allows paraprofessionals to represent people in court in limited situations, even without a law license. Private attorney groups have raised concerns that these changes could open the door to unregulated companies preying on people who need help. Meanwhile, LeMay says Congress could help by adjusting eligibility requirements so more people could qualify for legal aid groups that have attorneys on staff. He says these groups also need more funding to serve more clients.
When I started in 1989, Legal Services Corporation nationally was funded at $400 million. And here we are 32 years later, and granted, we're getting increases, but we're only at $465 million.
He adds public awareness is a big issue, and given all the financial challenges from last year, his group didn't see as many cases as expected. LeMay suggests that people in need of legal advice research any possible assistance options before deciding to represent themselves. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Biden transition officials have stated that the new administration will extend the pause on student loan payments and interest past the current expiration of January 31st. Advocates say much more is needed to alleviate the massive burden of student loan debt. Lily Bolke has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Although the directive to suspend student loan payments and waive interest is set to expire at the end of the month, Biden transition officials have promised that the new administration will extend it. More than 10% of Nevadans have student loan debt, and more than half of the state's respondents to a recent survey don't know when they'll be financially secure enough to start making loan payments again. Another 30% say they're not ready until June of this year or later. Cody Hananian, with the group Student Debt Crisis, says the extension of the pause on payments is critical, but so is further action for broad-based debt cancellation.
So the burden of student debt is something that is growing exponentially as people are facing unemployment or reduced hours or extra medical costs during this pandemic.
More than 20% of Nevada borrowers who responded reported that their financial wellness was poor or very poor. Now, during the pandemic, that number has increased to more than 55%. Hananian says with the new makeup of the U.S. Senate, he expects to see certain changes, such as a fix to public service loan forgiveness programs, an end to the bankruptcy law provision that places a higher bar to discharge student loan debt, and even refinancing reforms for federal student loans. He says organizations, lawmakers, and experts want to implement these fixes as well as go further, provide permanent debt cancellation for as many people as possible.
For those that are listening that feel that their lawmakers have not been listening to them in relation to the student debt crisis, now is the time. And I'm feeling very optimistic that change is just right around the corner.
Borrowers in the U.S. owe roughly $1.6 trillion in student debt, more than the nation's credit card debt combined. Hananian says if someone's not being crushed by student debt themselves, they almost certainly know someone else who is. And that's why the chorus of advocates is growing. For Nevada News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey.
The National Congress of American Indians calls for accountability following violence at the Capitol and First Nations start to receive COVID-19 vaccines. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. National Congress of American Indians Administrative Board officers are urging those responsible for last week's violent events at the U.S. Capitol to be held accountable, including President Trump. In a statement Friday, NCAI President Fawn Sharp and executive board officers denounced the violence, saying the actions incited by President Trump and his enablers are rooted in systemic and acute racism and hate and represent direct attacks on our democracy. The statement goes on to say, no one is above the law. Tribal leaders across the country also condemned the violence last week, and some stated they're on heightened alert, including the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico and the Oglala Sioux tribe in South Dakota, to ensure safety of their communities. Vaccines for COVID-19 are starting to roll out to Indigenous communities across Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the first shipments of the Moderna vaccine are on their way to First Nations in Manitoba.
According to Native organizations and the provincial government of Manitoba, the first doses went out late last week. Officials say there are already 5,300 doses allocated to First Nations, with another 5,300 coming by the end of February. David Monius is the chief of the Pimicacamac First Nation. He addressed the reluctance that some people might have in taking the vaccine.
My job is to bring the vaccine into my community for my people, and it's up to them to decide if they want to take it or not, and nobody's going to be forced.
Another chief said officials have to prioritize where the vaccines would go first, such as vulnerable, isolated, or overcrowded communities. Some Native leaders say the province's Native communities have been under severe stress since the pandemic began. Many don't have the infrastructure or the health systems to properly cope with the pandemic. The first doses will go to elder care homes in the communities of Cross Lake, Norway House, Fisher River Cree Nation, and the Peguis First Nation. A recent report from the Pandemic Response Coordination Team said in Manitoba, 49% of active cases in the overall population are in Native people. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Secaugan Chippewa community in Wisconsin has been vaccinating healthcare workers and vulnerable community members against COVID-19. WXPR's Katie Thorson reports.
The first people to get vaccinated against COVID-19 in the Secaugan Chippewa community are just about ready to get their second doses. Health Director Jamie Zarda says they've been fortunate to get enough of the Pfizer vaccine to administer doses to all of the health clinic staff as well as tribal elders.
It was so exciting for us to be able to get that.
Zarda was one of the first to get vaccinated. She said she didn't have any reaction to it other than a sore arm.
We've had a few, you know, slight reactions like enlarged lymph nodes, dizziness, but nobody has said that they will not get the second vaccine.
Zarda says, by and large, vaccine rollout has gone smoothly within the community. With every dose that's administered, Zarda says the community gets closer to reopening.
We are very restricted right now.
During the pandemic, the Secaucus Chippewa community has kept the Mole Casino closed. It's also restricted access to the Senex convenience store and gas station. They're all measures taken to try and prevent the spread of the virus.
You know, with the Native American community, it can wipe out the community. So we really need and want everybody in the community, or as many as possible, to get vaccinated so we can open up and kind of get back to a regular lifestyle.
Zarda says the goal is to get 80% of the population vaccinated. She encourages everyone who is able to get the vaccine. If you're hesitant, Zarda recommends reading up on it from reliable sources.
The vaccine is safer than getting the COVID itself.
I'm Katie Thorson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A recent report evaluates each state's science standards to see how clearly and accurately they cover climate change. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many states do not require schools to adequately teach students about climate change. That's according to a report from the Texas Freedom Network Education Fund and the National Center for Science Education, or NCSE. They evaluated each state's science standards to see how clearly and accurately they cover the causes and consequences of climate change. Each state received a grade. Wyoming was the only one to receive an A.
20 earned a C+ or worse, 10 received a D or worse, and those include some of the most populous states in the country, such as Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio.
Glenn Branch of NCSE says state standards influence not only what's taught in the classroom, but the content of textbooks, tests, and teacher training. So he says it's important for all states to implement standards that reflect the scientific consensus that climate change is real and human-caused. Until they do, he suggests that concerned parents encourage their local schools to go beyond what the standards require.
Merely reassuring your child's science teacher that you fully support their teaching climate change in an accurate, honest, and complete fashion can do a lot to encourage them.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
According to new research from Oregon State University, solar panels on 1% of farmlands could produce 20% of the country's electricity need. The study also found that developing solar next to agriculture could be beneficial for farmers. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
If a small fraction of farms captured solar energy, it could produce a large slice of the country's energy needs and boost farmers' bottom line. New research from Oregon State University finds that 1% of farmland in the U.S. could provide 20% of the country's electricity needs through solar power. Co-author of the paper Chad Higgins says farmers could treat sunlight as a resource in the same way they treat water or soil health.
Most plants don't need the full amount of sunlight that comes to the land, and a fraction of that can be productively harvested and made into electricity with solar panels.
The research says the U.S. would need to invest less than 1% of its annual budget in order to achieve this, and that it would create more than 100,000 jobs in rural communities. Higgins says the cooling effect from plants also would make solar panels more efficient. Higgins is bringing this research to life on a farm in Aurora, about 20 miles south of Portland. He says most experiments on developing solar energy and agriculture side by side focus on the solar part, and then farming is shoehorned in.
None of those systems were amenable to large-scale production agriculture. There wasn't really thought given to how do you get the tractors through, how do you get the harvesters through, how do you make sure there's radius enough to turn the tractors around.
In Aurora, Higgins says he's taking the opposite approach, permitting and investing in the project like a farmer would. He says leasing land out for solar projects could boost income for landowners and farm operators, and also give them a steady and guaranteed income. He says farmers are a crucial part of our energy future.
Essentially, what it does is it makes farmers the energy barons of the future.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 11th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, Lily Bolke, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio. Host Dime Roberts speaks with actor, teaching artist, and co-director of the Vanport Mosaic, Damaris Webb. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Aurora Josephson interviews local painter Melinda Thorsnes about her current work, including a series of anti-MAGA paintings. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, exploring the anti-herbicide movement in the Pacific Northwest.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. To hear past episodes of Coast Range Radio, you can visit coastrange.org/coastrangeradio or find us on your favorite podcasting service. Today's interview is with troublemaker and author Carol Van Strum. Carol is an inspiration and has been active in the fight to end aerial herbicide spray in Oregon since the 1970s. Carol is featured in the new documentary film, The People vs. Agent Orange, which is having an advanced screening online through the Darkside Cinema in Corvallis, January 15th through the 28th. The special run will be restricted to viewers within the state of Oregon. Future screenings will be at the Hollywood Theater in Portland, Ashland Independent Film Festival, and others starting in early March. To learn more about the film and to get tickets, visit www.thepeoplevsagentorange.com. This is the first episode of Coast Range Radio in 2021, and we look forward to bringing expanded interviews and a diversity of voices to the podcast and radio show. Listen for exciting changes as we move into the new year. And now, here's the episode. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio. I am here, very fortunate, very appreciative. Today I am speaking with a longtime troublemaker and author, Carol Van Strum. Carol has spent years documenting and fighting the atrocities perpetuated on the rural communities of the Pacific Northwest by massive chemical corporations and the federal government. She is the recipient of the David Brower Lifetime Achievement Award. She has compiled the Poison Papers along with authoring the works of A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, No Margin of Safety, The Oriole Files, and several other works. In 2017, Carol's work was instrumental in her county's first voter-approved ban of aerial pesticide spraying in the nation. Carol, thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
I really appreciate and Carol, when I was reading your book, A Bitter Fog, and watching the film that you're recently featured in called The People vs. Agent Orange, I was deeply moved by you and your community's story and your standing up to the federal government and these powerful chemical companies like Monsanto and Dow Chemical. I was hoping that in order to kind of set the stage for folks understanding what we're talking about, I was could you help just kind of describe your first, what happened to get you involved in this fight against herbicides, against these companies and the government's perpetuation of these use of these herbicides, and how that led into your decades of troublemaking and writing these books?
Well, like most people, I started off totally naive about any of this until our children got sprayed by a county road crew when they were down by the river. The road runs right along the river. And shortly after that, the U.S. Forest Service sprayed the entire ridge almost surrounding our place. And when we found out that the ingredients that they were spraying were the same as Agent Orange, but at first we thought, oh, it's a mistake. They put the wrong thing in their tanks or something, and we just didn't believe that they would do this deliberately. But because my children got really sick, we had all poultry hatching with, you know, feet on backwards and crossed beaks, and our dog died. It was horrifying what happened. And when we looked at the river and saw what happened there, it was even more horrifying, because there were dead fish floating all over. There were dead crayfish. There were dead ducklings, the merganser ducklings that we'd been watching. And scientist named Michael Newton wrote a glowing article about the use of these chemicals in forestry and what a revolutionary, wonderful thing they were. So they could clear cut and then spray the hell out of clear cut stripped land and replant it. And I kind of saw red, and I wrote a response to his article, which was published in our local newspaper, in the News Times. And you have to realize we had just moved out here the year before. We didn't really know anybody, but very suddenly the people who live out here were coming to us and saying, hey, the same thing happened to us. We didn't know what was causing it, and told even more horror stories of horses losing all their hair and finding deformed deer in the forest. So the upshot was, we got together with our neighbors and with some folks over the ridge in Deadwood and called the Forest Service to come in so we could present to them what was going on, figuring, well, that's how naive we were. We thought if we told them how bad this was for us and what was happening to us, of course they wouldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. What year was that?
That was in 1976.
In 76.
Yeah, and 75. Well, it was 75 and 76, because the articles happened in 75. And then what happened was, after several go-rounds with the Forest Service, we ended up finding a lawyer who would take our case and sue the federal government to make them stop. And that was the beginning of our our adventures.
So I'm curious, what were they actually using? What were these chemicals, and how easy or difficult was it to figure out just exactly what they were doing, and how these chemicals impacted people, the environment? How did you figure all that out?
Well, it took a while. There was no internet back then, you know. Mm-hmm. And we live, a good 40, 50 miles away from Corvallis, where there's any university library. But the chemicals they were using were a mixture of 50-50, pretty much, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, which was the same mixture they used in Vietnam. Mm. And so there was already, by that time, quite a bit of information about the use in Vietnam and what happened there, because largely of some articles in the New Yorker back in 1970, by Thomas Whiteside, which pretty much blew the whistle on what was going on over there. Nobody knew what they were doing.
Wow.
And thanks to his articles, Senator Hart held congressional hearings, and the upshot of that was they were banned from using it. The military was banned from using it in Vietnam. At that point, the chemical companies, their entire supply had been going into the military. You know, they were building new factories even to produce enough for the military. And all of a sudden, they couldn't use it there. So guess what they did? Of course, they promoted it for use here.
Wow.
And forestry, thanks to OSU's connections with Dow Chemical largely, they started heavily promoting it for use in forestry, on rangeland, on rights of way, like the county right of way, like railroad rights of way. So the use just skyrocketed in the United States. And that's what we were discovering.
Wow. Wow.
And because of what we were reading about what happened in Vietnam, we got very concerned, of course, about their use of it here. And so that's how we began finding out. But it took many trips over to OSU and phone calls.
Yeah.
There was no internet. There was no free communication. We ran up phone bills like you would not believe. Because we ended up calling the scientists who had written the articles that originally caused the ban of it in Vietnam, and a number of them actually volunteered to testify in our court case because none of them knew what was going that this was happening.
Oh, wow. Wow.
It was, yeah.
I'm interested in your book. You talk about the difference, these issues with this kind of faulty science or really corrupt science, and then this idea of anecdotal evidence, where your experience, your children getting sick, the wildlife and livestock, you're the animals that are exposed, getting, you know, horrible deformities and dying, and how was that accepted in the court case or by these folks in power, the federal government, these chemical companies? What's the issue there with anecdotal evidence? And then we can go into some of this fraudulent science.
Well, of course, at the time that we were talking about, that was mid-1970s. Unfortunately, we were pitted, our anecdotal evidence, our circumstantial evidence, whatever you want to call it, was pretty much dismissed. Because the government said they had the science on their side. Well, then it didn't turn out. We didn't find out till much later that the science was fraudulent. But at the time, we didn't know. And we did have some medical documentation of what went on here. But thanks to the government intimidating the people here, the physician that had done the surveys and the examinations could not present individual data on what happened to people because the federal government would then insist on putting these individuals, people like us who live out here, put them through their own medical examinations and testing and all, and that just was too big an intrusion and too intimidating to most people. So all we had was this physician's summaries of what she found. And that was basically all. But a few years later, when I was working on my book, A Bitter Fog, which Sierra Club's interest then was, at the time that they contracted for the book, was just the stories of the people who brought this lawsuit. Because it was an amazing thing, suing the federal government and a bunch of people living out in the woods. It just hadn't happened before. And that's what the book started out to be. And midway through was when Peter von Stackelberg, the Canadian journalist, uncovered the lab fraud upon which all the registrations, both in this country and in Canada, were based. were fraudulent and or non-existent. They wow. called them magic pencil studies. They just made them up. And they were the main one, or the initial one, was called Industrial Biotest Labs in Northbrook, Illinois. They were unbelievable what they did. And they were the biggest contractor with chemical companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the U.S. military. And they were just churning out fake data to support the use of these things. That's so at that point, we had our evidence, our circumstantial or anecdotal evidence, against fraudulent evidence. Which are you going to believe? That's when we filed a subsequent lawsuit against the Forest Service, I think, and the BLM, and NCAP, Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. They joined in. I think a couple of other groups joined in. Basically, it ended up with the Ninth Circuit of the U.S. courts upholding a ban on the Forest Service using any of these chemicals because they were based on fraudulent data. And if the Forest Service wanted to use them, they had to do their own studies. And that was kind of a real turning point because they couldn't use them anymore.
And has that lasted, that ban? Have those chemicals no longer been used?
Well, basically, the U.S. Forest Service, for a number of reasons, including that and the controversy over the spotted owl, the marbled murrelet, and endangered species, the Forest Service did an amazing turnaround. A guy named Jim Furness, who was the superintendent, is that what he's called, I think, of the Siuslaw Forest here in Oregon, and then later went to D.C. and became the deputy head honcho, I forget what the position, and he did a 180. He was opposed to us 100% for years, and amazingly enough started looking at what was going on and did a whole 180 and changed the policy of the Forest Service that essentially eliminated clear cutting, which was the reason they sprayed in the first place, was because they had to control so-called unwanted vegetation on their clear cuts. Anyway, that pretty much shut down spraying, aerial spraying in the national forests. I don't know. I think they've probably, under Trump, they're coming back with some of it and trying to anyway, but.
So I know that, and I think many of our listeners know and see the, you know, massive clear cuts on private timberlands in Oregon, and these more like foothill areas, some of these really productive areas in the Coast Range, and they do aerial herbicide spraying on these private lands. Are they using these same chemicals?
They're not using 2,4-5-T. That was another development out of our original Katz case in the 70s. Was ultimately 2,4-5-T was banned totally. Again, involved some scandals over tests that EPA had concealed for 4 years, and when we uncovered them, finding dioxin, which is an incredible contaminant of both 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. But at that time, thanks to chemical lies, the 2,4-D was believed not to have dioxin in it, which was, it was not, that's not true. But anyway, after we uncovered those samples, finding high levels of dioxin in people's water supplies out here, and in things like the tissue of a baby born without a brain, and wildlife, other things, anyway, the chemical companies withdrew all their registrations for 2,4-5-T, and it has not been produced on American soil since or used.
That's a very important win. That's really important. 2,4-D though, is that still used to this day?
It is still used extensively, and another lovely chemical, glyphosate or Roundup, yeah, was another one that was tested by Industrial Biotest Labs. What happened with that whole testing scandal was that EPA and the chemical companies and Health Environment, I think they're called, Canada, got together. When was that? 1978, I think. I can't remember the exact year. Their whole purpose in meeting, and unbelievably, they had a court reporter taking everything down, so we have a record of it, was to discuss how to keep these chemicals on the market, even though there is no valid data supporting their use. And what they came up with was, oh, wonderful, we'll just issue conditional registrations, and then the chemical companies can resubmit data as they find it, as they develop it, supporting its use. So, and on top of that, they further decided EPA wouldn't look at the raw data for the studies that industry submitted anymore. So there was no way to tell if there was fraud, because you wouldn't have the raw data where any anomalies or inconsistencies would show up. And EPA would only look at summaries that the chemical companies prepared themselves of their own studies.
Wow. Jeez.
So it's on that basis, glyphosate or Roundup and a bunch of other chemicals, atrazine, 2,4-D, I can't remember all the other ones, but that are still used today in the Coast Range by private industry, corporate industry, I call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's mostly industrial forests. And the state forestry department, they're still used heavily. Yes, you've seen those clear cuts. It looks like, this is like strip mining in the Appalachians or something. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And in the end of your book, you talk about this idea of, informed consent, informed discretion.
Right.
What is that? And how is that, solution you offer, or a potential pathway to dealing with this, how has that played out over the years, and how has that changed for you over that time?
Well, on an individual basis, I still think it's a valid thing to fight for. If your doctor prescribes a drug, that drug company has to provide you, and that's why you see those ads with six pages of side effects. That's your informed part of informed consent. They have to tell you what that can possibly do to you. They don't have to do that with chemicals. So they can expose you without your knowledge or consent, much less informed consent. And that's just dead wrong. They should not be allowed to do that. So on an individual basis, I think that's something we should be fighting for. I don't know. There's so many things going wrong today. I don't know how to fight for this one.
I think plays into so many issues, though. You know.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, it's not just
into the whole idea of community consent.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more powerful in terms of. You're always more powerful when you have a bunch of voices instead of just one. And that's why I love the whole community rights movement and the idea that a community can say no to this stuff. No, you can't spray our water supply. No, you can't spray our roads or whatever. And unfortunately, the chemical industry, thanks to ALEC, has in many states, like in Oregon, they have something called, they've introduced and had passed with their bought and paid for legislators, something called the right to farm laws, which basically mean that state law allowing these chemicals preempts any kind of local control. And that is just dead wrong. Sorry, I almost swore.
Well, it's you know, rightfully so. These are it's horrible. So what is the community rights movement?
Well, it's basically if there is an action such as aerial spraying or fracking or pipelines that threaten the health and safety of a community, the community is demanding its right to say no. And either through local measures like we had in Lincoln County that ban a particular activity, or through other means. But the main thing is that it's a community saying no, not just an individual. And I think it makes it much more powerful, and I think it's growing nationwide. And the other development from that, which is very, very dear to my heart, is the rights of nature, because I feel like other countries have even adopted in their constitutions, they're giving rights to natural systems, to nature itself. And in other words, anybody can stand up and speak for the trees and or the rivers or the whole ecosystem, whatever it is. And we did that in our community rights movement here, and in the ballot measure that passed, we gave that ecosystem rights on its own so that anybody could speak up for them. And I was very proud to be named the Lorax and stand up for them in court. That was, to me, a huge, huge honor.
I read that. That's amazing. And so that's, you're talking about the Lincoln County Freedom from Aerial Spray Pesticides Ordinance.
Is right.
That, yeah. So over the years of this work and, you know, kind of the progression going from these lawsuits back first fighting the Forest Service and the use of these chemicals, what is your experience with what's happening today with some of these really big issues, climate change, you know, some big movements that are happening to address these, you know, worldwide issues and worldwide crises that, you know, are very similar in the way that they're perpetuated in the experiences that you had? Where are we today, and what's a little advice maybe that you have for activists who are engaged, troublemakers who are engaged today trying to make a better world?
My main advice is you've got to keep a sense of humor, because if you don't, you're going to burn out. It's too big. Yes, and it's all tied together. Human rights, civil rights, environmental rights, and the planet's rights, as far as I'm concerned. And I mean, we're the only species that's ever managed to destroy a whole planet. Is that something we really want for a legacy? You know, it's horrifying. But people need to, I would say, just do what you can, even if it's just writing letters to the editor. Setting out to change the world, you'll never make it. You know, it's Don Quixote all over again. But do what you can in a small way and join with others who feel the same. And then you join with others and it grows. I don't know how else it's going to happen. It's not going to happen by any kind of government fiat. It's not going to happen with some savior coming along. It's going to happen from people. And they need to wake up. I mean, really need to wake up to what's going on.
I really appreciate you saying keeping a sense of humor. We're all people trying to make a life better for each other. These conversations are so important in coming together, you know, building our power. I really appreciate that. So thank you so much for saying that.
Oh, good. Well, I think it gives some perspective too. You've got to realize that, yes, you're dealing with really heavy subjects, but the people you're dealing with, the nozzle heads, we always called them, they're people too. And they're susceptible to ridicule, and it's empowering to ridicule them. It really is. So that's important,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And the whole idea that, you know, you're not going to save the world, but if you can make one bureaucrat crap his pants, that's a victory.
That's awesome. That's so good. Well, Carol, where would you recommend folks finding your writings, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, your other books? Where can people find those?
Well, they can get them on Amazon. There's a little bookstore in Nye Beach in Newport that's selling my books.
Nye Beach Bookhouse?
That sounds like it, yes.
Cool. Great. Yeah, Carol, I look forward to speaking with you more in the future and working together. And really, once again, want to kind of end on that. You recommend recommendations that you made, you know, keep the humor, be able to go for the long haul and come together with community. You're not by yourself. There's a lot of folks working on this.
Yes, good.
Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for coming on Coast Range Radio.
Well, thank you. I think you guys are wonderful. So.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness.